Lasso. So let's begin with a very short experiment. We're all seated more or less in meditative posture already. This will be very, very short. But just when I snap my fingers, just a kind of a starting point. When I snap my fingers, just take one natural breath without forcing anything, just breathing in, breathing out. As you breathe in, arouse your attention, focusing your attention on the sensations of the abdomen, arousing. And then as you breathe out, just completely relax, but still maintain that awareness of the sensations at the abdomen. Just one breath, okay? Anaso, I assume you're finished. Anybody have a problem with that? I don't mean to embarrass anybody, but did anybody find that like, what? Like, I don't get it? Okay, then you can all achieve shamatha. Because achieving shamatha consists just of doing that and then doing it again and then again, right? But not having the notion, oh, I have to do that for 24 minutes or for 2 hours or for 8 hours a day, that's tiring. That thought is tiring. 8 hours of anything, even eating ice cream for 8 hours, that kind of, oh. I like ice cream a lot, but you know. So it's that allowing your awareness to release the grasping onto time, duration, and having a whole bunch of very short sessions, just breath by breath, success by success, and saying, I can do that, I just did it. Nobody had any problem. And I imagine, I'm just going to guess here, I won't ask for a raise of hands, but I'll bet during that one breath your mind was quite quiet, right? Wasn't that hard, right? Yeah. So that's how easy it is. So quite a number of you in our meetings are commenting that you are exploring whole new dimensions of needing to relax. You can call it tension, tightness, effort, and so forth. And so good, now is a good place to learn how to relax more deeply, develop some skills there. And this practice, as you well know, we're going to be focusing on the abdomen. This practice is just that beautiful balance that enables us to cultivate an ever so important balance that we'll need for kind of any task that lasts more than a second or two. And that is to be able to maintain it, whether it's driving in heavy traffic, maintaining a conversation, a business meeting, and so forth and so on. Any kind of task, even enjoyable ones like entertainment or recreation, that requires some continuity of attention, right? To be able to maintain continuity of attention and not do what neuroscientists and psychologists have noted that we do, and that is when we're really focusing for a sustained period, we do by contraction, we do by effort, by ego, by tightening up and then draining ourselves and getting exhausted in the process. I mean, there must be hundreds of studies by now. That's how people concentrate. That's how people concentrate. Okay, now focus. Okay, and then we seize up. We clamp down. And we can do it. And it works. And that's why we keep on doing it, because it does work. We can concentrate. We can sustain our attention. But then always with that wear and tear. And so that, again, that's the fundamental fork in the road between the ordinary, goal-driven, ego-driven, effortful, how do you say, application of sustained attention, focused attention, and the contemplative way, which from the very first step is already different, and that is a releasing first. A releasing, the relaxation, and then the stability, rather than first the ego driving the stability. Right? So first that relaxation, and then out of a sense of ease, we let the attention drop onto the object, and then sustain with a sense of ease, then allow that continuity. And when interruptions come up, most likely distracting thoughts, then again, rather than trying to push them away or clamp them down, suppress them, we continue in that same vein of just relaxing, releasing, 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 and letting the continuity come out of releasing rather than contraction. Okay? So you might watch, when you describe even your practice to yourself, you might watch your hand gestures, because I watch your hand gestures when we speak. And if you see your hands going like this, into a fist, it's probably telling you something, right? Whereas if you see your hands going like this, palms open, out, that tells you something as well. So really concentrate. And that kind of tells it all, okay? And then in terms of the counting, I'm front-loading this a little bit so I can speak less when we're actually doing the meditation, and so you don't have to multitask so much. Because I know at some point, and maybe you've already crossed that threshold, hearing guidance coming in when you don't need it is just kind of, maybe not annoying, but a bit distracting. And it does call for multitasking. Okay, what is he saying now? Okay, thank you. Are you going to talk? Are you going to stop now? No. You're not. So I'm trying to find that middle way. But this is why I'm front-loading it now. And if we do a final cycle, we probably will. Then I found it worked well last year. When we're doing the final cycle, coming into the home stretch, then I just front-load everything. And if there's any comments to be made that I think might be helpful, I do that before the session. And then you can just be really practicing samadhi, the unification of the mind, and not going back and forth from the object of meditation or to my voice, okay? But still, we're here in the third cycle. So what was that? I think it's the final point. But I know you'll never believe me now when I say that, but that's cool. You know I'm sincere. Even if I'm mistaken, I'm still sincere. And that is the counting business, okay? And so it occurred to me, because I just had a massage, sometimes the masseuse or masseur will ask, do you like it light, medium, or strong, right? And so likewise with the counting, if you want the counting at all, do you want light, medium, or strong? And light is breathing in, ding, one little count, one. Releasing out quietly, releasing thoughts. The breath comes in, ding, two. That's light. Very light touch. Light touch. One little light, boring thought. One thought per cycle of respiration. Very light, like a little staccato, little light touch. Ding, like that. Right? If you'd like to have medium, then one at the end of inhalation, two at the end of exhalation, three at the end inhalation, four at the end of exhalation, so it keeps you a bit more engaged. And then you know what the strong one is. One, 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 two, 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 two. Whenever you see the head bopping up, could we play a game for just 30 seconds? Okay. At anybody who feels like it, clear your throat as if you're about to talk. One. Oh, my God, that was way too many. Just a few of you then. A few of you. Just, and sporadically, not all at once. I mean, that's too sweet. I just say one, and I wipe you all out with one word. Okay, let's do it again. One. That was one, one, one. Okay, I think you know what I'd like you to do, and that is, if we had three people here, we'd go, one, one, one. And so I just shut you up right there, you know, so you don't get too prolonged the conversation. Hello, my name is Joe. Just as soon as one. Right. Tsongkhapa, when he speaks about distraction, it's quite interesting. He says when your introspection skills are somewhat honed, getting a bit sharper, he said, not only will you note a distracting thought when it arises, but you'll note a distracting thought when it's about to arise. You'll see it clearing its throat. You'll see a perturbation, a kind of a movement that's not yet quite conceptually articulated. And even when you see that rise to a thought about to arise, then if you're counting, you can go one, hit it with a dart, one, one. Or if you like no massage at all, that is no counting at all, then what do? Then it's always just relaxation. Whenever you see the thought coming up, a thought about to come up, it's just kind of a relaxation, releasing and releasing, okay? So counting is not for everybody. It's something that if you find it helpful, go for strong, medium, or light. If you don't find it helpful, don't do it at all. Or again, something in between. Sometimes when you find that you're just kind of a lot of stuff coming up, then you might just say, okay, I'm going to try a cycle of 5 or a cycle of 10. Just one cycle, see how that goes. And that may be enough. By the time you get to 10, you may find, oh, it's quiet again, pretty quiet. And then you can carry on without the counting. Okay? But this groundedness and this lovely balance, really to be cultivated, to be nurtured, to develop a real skill during our remaining 3 weeks and a day, And that is this wonderful skill of not only sustaining the sense of ease, relaxation, looseness, as you develop greater stability, coherence, continuity, but the real sweetness of this practice is when, as your mind does get quieter, as you're approaching flow, you know, that nice, less and less effortful continuity, that with that quiet and that ongoing quiet and composure of attention, that there's actually a deepening of relaxation, because it's peaceful. It's nice to be in a quiet place. You're not being jarred all the time by thoughts popping up. And so then more sense of relaxation, like, oh, this is nice. And there's that greater sense of ease, of looseness, relaxation, then the stability is easier to maintain, less effort to maintain, because there's just not so much to do, not so many, remedies to be applied. And so then you get into that synergy of just a gently deepening sense of ease, of relaxation, of looseness, as the stability and coherence of the mind is getting stronger, a bit more enclosed, a bit more unified, a bit more continuous, and then you're really stepping towards flow. Okay? So now here's the final point. And that is, you recall in the first phase, I'm applying from the Buddha's own teachings, when you breathe in long, you know you breathe in long, out long, in short, out short. So that business, right? Just basic, very primitive way of knowing, or degree or magnitude of knowing. There's so many things that we can know that are much more complicated than short breath, long breath. That's very, very basic, right? And it can be known without cogitation. We don't have to think about it, right? Any more than if I hold up a long finger and a short finger. You don't have to think, you know, which one's longer, which one's shorter. I mean, you just look at it and you just know. And likewise, short breath, long breath. You know, you don't have to worry about how short is it, 75%, 37%. No, just more or less, long or short. Keep it simple. But we're tapping into here. This actually turns out to be quite profound. Tapping into a way of knowing that is pre-conceptual. The kind of knowing that's left over when your coarse mind is dissolved into the substrate consciousness. And you're still knowing. But now you're not knowing by way of language. Not knowing by way of personal history. Not knowing by way of conceptualization, because it's a non-conceptual state. But you're still knowing. So we're going kind of primal there. And it's not dull, it's not blurry, it's not nothing stupid about it. It's just, it's not talking. So we're developing that ability in a very simple fashion, short or long, in that first phase, full body awareness. But now as we move to this one, right, rise and fall of the abdomen, now we'll just take that third line from the Buddha's four-line instruction. And that is attending to the whole body. One breathes in, attending to the whole body, one breathes out. Now you're going for it. Now there's definitely an element of discipline, looking for continuity, and see if you can be present for the whole course of the in-breath, whether it's long or short, being with the whole way. And then that turnaround point. And now down the slide, all the way through the out-breath and being there the whole way as you're relaxing, getting a bit of relief there that is not all effort, all the way through the end, all the way. And then the breath flows in and you're there all the way and just have a whole bunch of short sessions. But having a session, one session by session, respiration by respiration, seeing if you can be there the whole duration, the whole body of the breath. That's kind of the challenge. But don't take on the challenge, can I do that for 24 minutes? Take on a whole bunch of little short challenges. Can I do it for this breath? Okay? And then we just did it. And I think you know you can do it, because that's how we started this little chat, this monologue chat. Okay? I'm finished. Now I won't need to talk much, which I'm very happy for. step by step. Settle first of all your body in its natural state. Then your speech in its natural state by way of settling the respiration in its natural rhythm. And finally, settle the mind, releasing all thoughts about the future and the past, letting your awareness come to rest luminously, clearly, in stillness in the present moment. Now, keeping your eyes soft, relaxed, unfocused, direct just your mental awareness down to the level of the abdomen. Without visualizing the abdomen or thinking about it, just attending to the bare tactile sensations. Focus on those sensations correlated with the in and out breath, arousing with each in breath, relaxing with each out breath. Monitor the flow of attention with introspection, applying the remedies as needed. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Or lasso. So we'll start with James, if you still have a comment or question, observation. So start over here, then I'll go left, and then I'll go to the one comment or question, looks like question here.
I'd like to make a comment, and then I have a question.
Sure.
And I take a risk in making the comment.
Say again?
I take a risk in making the comment because it may be an admission of how dense and dumb I am. But
I couldn't quite hear. A risk of?
Of an admission of how dense and dumb I am.
Dense and dumb. Acha. I don't usually call my students dense and dumb, but we can give it a shot.
So I was practicing today, and I noticed
maybe
that I
was... Maybe a bit further away from your mouth. A little bit further.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
I was doing mindfulness of breathing today,
right.
And I noticed that I had been looking for some kind of monolithic breath, you know, like a monolithic sensation of the breath, when I noticed that it's actually a whole bunch, you know, dozens or hundreds or whatever of, fizzing little impermanent sensations.
Yeah.
And so it just made it a lot easier.
Good, good.
I hope that's
very
helpful.
Good. Yeah.
So that's my comment.
Yeah,
and my question is about practice, but it is not about this practice today, so perhaps
okay.
I can wait.
Sure, that's okay.
Is it okay?
Sure.
Okay. I suffer a lot from what I guess Oliver Sacks calls earworms.
Earworms?
Yeah. They're those little fragments of songs that play over and over.
Uh-huh.
I have a new one every day.
Uh-huh. It's fun. Oh, yeah, I've got
fun.
A repertoire.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. It's about a 5-day rotation. So, yeah,
uh-huh.
5 weeks. So,
uh-huh.
But you know, it's easy when you're doing mindfulness of breathing because you know the instruction is basically just to ignore it.
Yeah, but just release it. Yeah, exactly.
Settling the mind is a little bit more dicey for me because I guess there is some aversion to it because I would like it to stop, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But when I let it go. I guess. I'm not exactly sure if it's grasping because the song just kind of plays itself out in a lot of detail.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've indirectly addressed this many times maybe, but maybe you have a comment.
Yeah, although having your own little DJ running the tunes over and over again, that hasn't quite come up in that phrasing. That's good. When we came out of this session just now, it just kind of really loomed large in my mind. How easily there can arise a strong preference for silence over chit-chat. Just having that sweet silence and continuity, some peace and quiet, you know, among bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. Non-conceptuality is really quite okay, you know? And so, and we get that. I mean, we're dishing that up. We're cultivating that in mindfulness of breathing. And when it happens, it's quite satisfying to have some real peace and quiet and some continuity, some flow in that. But of course, as much as we gravitate to that in mindfulness of breathing, when it comes to settling the mind in this natural state, we have to release even that preference. That's a really core element of the practice, to release the preference for silence over activity or preference for stillness over movement in the mind and develop this evenness, this complete lack of preference for not only silence versus movement, but also within the movements of the mind, this type of memory versus that type of memory, this type of fantasy versus that type of emotion, this type of desire versus that type of image or thought. But developing that type of evenness, that type of impartiality or equilibrium, is really core. It's really striking at the very core of the practice as a whole. So, of course, that's going to be difficult. But this is why this practice, more than any other, is the one that is highlighted by the great Mahamudra and Dzogchen masters for the last 1,000 years at least, as the optimal shamatha preparation for venturing into bona fide Mahamudra or Dzogchen practice. Because, boy, then you're really going for that total impartiality, the equality. I mean, if it were a poker game, you've just raised the ante. And that is no preference. I mean, where we're going is no preference for nirvana over samsara. But within samsara, no preference for this or that. Because one is seeking, when I'm talking about Dzogchen, I'll just talk that rather than say Mahamudra Dzogchen, Dzogchen, is where you're going in bona fide Dzogchen practice, the tekchu and then the tutgel, the direct crossing over, is seeking to so release grasping on all levels, let alone, of course, the psyche level. But even releasing the grasping that occurs when you're resting in the sweetness of the substrate consciousness, where a natural, powerful inclination has come out, I do prefer the bliss over not bliss. I prefer luminosity over dullness. I prefer non-conceptuality over blah, 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 blah. And you're releasing right through that and seeking to so release the grasping on even the subtlest level that you're able to view whatever comes up from a point of total lucidity. If we take the lucid dream analogy, total lucidity, whether it's arising in your body, in the other sense fields, in your mind, that you're viewing it from such a deep perspective, namely Rigpa, that from that perspective of Rigpa, the whole of samsara and nirvana actually is equally pure, right? And this, and the way we're getting there is not by the power of visualization and mantra and so forth and so on, as is done in stage regeneration and stage of completion practice, where we're kind of, in a very developmental way, we're going into override. We're kind of overwhelming the old habitual way of appearances arising and our responding to them, conceptually designating, imputing them, grasping onto them. That's going on. But we do our best in Vajrayana practice to dissolve that into emptiness, the habitual, ordinary appearances, ordinary way of grasping, to the best of our ability, dissolving that into emptiness, and then massive override. And this is where having achieved shamatha, really fully achieved it already, is really powerful. Because you've got this mind that can visualize big time. And then you artificially superimpose visualizations of yourself as the deity, the pure land, and so forth and so on, just like drowning out samsara by the power of your visualization and the way you're apprehending reality, the way you're conceptually designating it. You almost intimidate samsara, to squelch it, to intimidate it, to subdue it. And you know it's contrived, it's artificial, it's fabricated. But it's fabricated in accordance with reality rather than the same old of the old habitual delusion of non-lucid dreams. But when you go straight Dzogchen, of course you can precede Dzogchen with the stage of generation and completion, and many, many people do. I mean, it's sweet. But in principle, you might be able to imagine, well, let's not even go to the trouble of overriding all the ordinary appearances, ordinary way of conceiving of ourselves, other situations. Let's not try to override it with anything fabricated. Let's just drop it totally. Drop all grasping all the way down. And so just let your awareness, like it just fell out of an airplane, just plummet right down to the ground. Ground awareness. Where from that vantage point, you don't have to imagine. That's just the way things are. Because it's that one ground awareness, that Rigpa, that is equally present, if we go into Buddhist cosmology, in the deepest hell realm to the highest pure land, it's equally present through all of them. So if that's where you're resting, whether it's Akanishta, the highest pure realm, or the Vajra hell, or Akanishta hell, or what, something like that, you know, the worst of the worst, it's not different. Not from this perspective. From every other perspective, there's a difference. But not from this perspective. So I just went into the deep end of the pool, big time, for about 5 minutes. But now we say, okay, wait, let's roll that back. Meanwhile, here in Tanyapura, in May 1912, 2012, yeah, let's get this one right. This lifetime, I got it. We're trying to emulate that. So whatever comes up, some of you have mentioned some really nasty stuff coming up, sometimes in dreams. Sometimes while settling the mind, its natural state. Or if you're going for awareness of awareness, mindfulness of breathing on the cushion, and so you're just releasing all that stuff, then when you're off the cushion, then all the nasties come piling in, right? But this approach to shamatha is so emulating in kind of little league, emulating what they'll do in the big league of Dzogchen, is whatever comes up, being completely even about it. So even if it's you probably heard some song on the radio that says, "Man, is that? That's just. Well, I don't go there. But actually, on the radio, you know, you probably heard on the radio. I have. I won't give the example because I want to be focused. But I'll just say this: it was on a trip to Tibet, where the driver, I don't want to pick on any band, but he had a really kind of a cheesy teenage kind of band playing really cheesy teenage music. And he played it over and over and over again as we're driving about the wildlands of Tibet. And I must say, I couldn't view that very easily as being of one taste. I wanted to kick a very large boulder and just go, and so there'd be nothing left of that radio. It would be dead forever. Because he played the same soundtrack over and over and over again. But I didn't want to piss off the driver. So there we are. So that's the long-winded response to your question. And that is, just be with it. But also watch your phrasing. When you say you'll let it go, the phrasing here is really let it be. Let it be. You probably heard me, if I'm an employer, so here's Rosario. If imagine Rosario, my employee, and I'm the boss. And I turn to Rosario and say, Rosario, I'm letting you go. You know what that means. I'm firing her. Whereas if I turn over to Fran and say, oh, Fran, I'll just let you be. Then it must be okay. I'm not going to do anything. I'm letting him be, but letting her go. And so just the phrasing itself, even though we say, oh, that's being, nitpicking. Well, not quite, because letting go means go, right? Be gone. Whereas if you're just letting it be, that means if you get in your next session the worst of the worst music you've ever heard in your life playing for 24 minutes, even. And that's the practice. That's the practice. Yep, that's it. Good. All right. We haven't heard from Sally for a while. So Sally it is. And then I'll go to this one question here.
Thanks, Alma. You make a great microphone, Dakini, by the way. Thank you.
I always choose fleet-footed.
Yes, she skims around the room every afternoon. Thanks. My question is in relation to this morning. And I'd appreciate your comments about the alignment of wisdom and compassion.
Yeah.
Because without wisdom, what I've heard is being called idiot's compassion can arise. And I think in our Western culture, which can often be really imbued with an interpretation of Christianity, which is all around being good, doing good. So I'd actually appreciate what you've got to say about avoiding that sort of pitfall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I must say, just as a preface, when I was doing the research and then eventually writing my book, Mind in the Balance, I was just reveling in the Christian teachings because I was cherry-picking. I wasn't cherry-picking ones that I liked, because every single contemplative whose writings I chose, they were all highly respected in the tradition. So I wasn't choosing some weirdo here or there because he happened to say things I liked. But I was going back to the Desert Fathers, the Greek Orthodox, the Western Christian, that is Western Roman Catholicism, and just really kind of jaw-dropping wisdom there that really I found very deeply moving. I'm just going to mention that because you mentioned Christianity. Because there's an awful lot of dumb Christianity. But you don't have to look too far to find really dumb or idiot Buddhism, and then idiot atheism, and idiot, because idiots go everywhere. Unfortunately, there's kind of like no entry signs that aren't there. People need to go anywhere they like, Politics, science, religion, whatever. But the book was Into the Silent Land by Martin Laird, who himself, he's a member of orders, Augustinian orders. I presume he's a monk, or at least a member of an order. But it's an outstanding book. It's really outstanding. It's the best, I think probably the best single tome I've seen on Christian contemplative practice. And it's so wise. So it's easy to find silliness within the modern, especially the fundamentalist Christian tradition, as it's easy to find silliness pretty much, in my view, in any fundamentalist tradition. So I just wanted to make that because, guess it's there. And that's obvious, just as like I was mentioned earlier. So Muslim terrorists are really obvious, but Muslim Sufis, where do you read about them in the modern media? And some of their writings and practices, as you well know, are so sublime. So since we get so much highlighting on silliness in religion, then I think we need to also mention, I want to mention for the sake of parity, some equilibrium here. That's why I spent 3 minutes talking about, wow, this is really deep. It's really, really cool, So on that notion, or on that theme, This actually came up in my mind, but it didn't come out my mouth this morning, before we came. And what I'm about to say is very explicitly true in the Buddhist tradition, and it's there. I think all one needs to do is look and look a little bit carefully, and you'll find it in multiple contemplative traditions. And I find it enormously meaningful, and it avoids the very pitfall that you focused on. Okay, the goody-goody business, the saccharine, the self-righteousness, aren't we good? And then sometimes, would you please stop being good? I can't quite take any more. You know, where it's goodness without wisdom, imposing our will on others because we know better for them. Oh, the white man's burden, converting people all over North and South America. Oh, one of the ghastliest episodes in human history. Where they, I will say one critical thing, because we all know it, but I mean the sword in the one hand and the Bible in the other. Oh, and by the way, we're going to shoot you if you don't give us your gold. I mean, that was a really weird combination. And it was all over North and South America coming from the Europeans. So that was, do we really call that Christianity or at all? But they thought what they were doing was righteous because they had these heathen, these savages, who they called Indians, showed how smart they were. You know, and they have to convert them to the one true faith. And if they don't, they just kill them. But, and even if they do convert to the one true faith, then they just enslave them. Ooh, bit creepy. So that's some of the worst, but I have mentioned some of the best. And now it's going to a theme that crops up, and I think you'll find it in the Sufi tradition, the Kabbalah, the Taoist, and so forth and so on. And that is three profoundly integrated themes. And the first of these is the cultivation of genuine happiness. Okay? So it's Aristotle, it's Taoism, it's Christianity, it's Hinduism, Buddhism. It crops up all over the place. The alternative mode of well-being that it's not stimulus-driven, it's not simply hedonic. And the wisdom traditions, and they don't have to be religious. Aristotle was not known for the religion he was promoting. And does anybody even know what religion he's promoting? You would have to be probably an Aristotelian scholar to kind of have to know that on the tip of your tongue. Plato and Socrates had a lot to say about eudaimonia, genuine happiness. So on the one hand here, what I'm doing here is, now it's very personal, I'm defining what for me constitutes the criteria of a meaningful life. So this for me is a big deal. It's very personal. But it's also, I think, quite universal, and then you can judge for yourself how universal it in fact is. But to my mind, a meaningful life has everything to do with the cultivation of genuine happiness. If one is not doing that, an absolutely crucial element is missing. Like a tricycle with one wheel missing. So there's a theme. There's nothing saccharine or cloying or self-righteous about wishing to re-experience more and more deeply genuine happiness. Okay, so there's one theme. I'm going to bring in three total. But now in order to experience and to have a deepening experience, both in solitude as well as when we're engaged, actively engaged, with the people, human beings, animals, and so forth around us, in order to deepen that experience, then of course that pursuit is nested in a way of being active. Most of the time we are active. We are engaging with other people, the environment, and so forth. So then we have to ask, all right, well, what's the nature of your engagement? While you're seeking genuine happiness, this type of well-being that comes from within, that is cultivated rather than simply hunting and gathering it, trying to gather from other people and the environment. As one is seeking such well-being, but in the meantime, we are active, right? We are active. Good. How are we active? If we are engaging in activities of body, speech, and mind that are harming those around us, out of our own self-centeredness, our greed, our hostility, our arrogance, our envy, and so forth, if that's what we're doing, if our way of life is heavily qualified by harmful behavior, then you may as well just stop with the genuine happiness and say, that's not going anywhere. It just won't happen. It can't happen. You cannot cultivate and deepen a sense of genuine happiness while mutilating the people around you. Something has to give, right? And so therefore, at the very least, there must be, it's not an optional, it's a mandatory, that in the cultivation of genuine happiness, it has to be rooted in a sensitivity, an awareness, an attentiveness to those around us, the inanimate environments, other species, our own human species, that we are leading a nonviolent way of life. That we're not injuring those, not intentionally, or not unless we clearly see there's a greater good for the being in question. So perhaps you want to spank your child or reprimand the child. Well, that doesn't feel very good, but you know, this is It's for the sake of the child. It's not so you can vent your spleen, right? And so, but then is that enough? Is that, should we just be satisfied there? Well, okay, I got by, didn't piss off anybody, didn't irritate anybody, and that was the nature of my activity in the world. Well, okay, that's better than nothing. That's better than being violent and brutal and injurious. But of course, we can go to the top side of the ledger now that we've come up to zero. You're not down in the deficit category. And see, well, oh, well, in terms of our activities, might we actually attend to others and want to help them out in some way, alleviate their suffering, help them find, satisfy their desires, whether as a professor, whether as a teacher, whether working in the business world and so forth, but can we offer something that's helpful? And so there we have, that's all of ethics. The cultivation of virtue, the virtue by way of activity, right? The virtue of avoiding non-virtue, avoiding injurious behavior, the virtue of actively engaging in modes of behavior, interactions that are truly helpful, bring something good to the world. And if one's not doing that, then you may as well just stop looking for genuine happiness because you won't find it because your whole way of life is going to undermine it. So it's going to be an exercise in futility and frustration. So we see these two, the cultivation of genuine happiness and the cultivation of virtue by way of activity. You just can't have. You will not succeed. It's already a done deal. It's one of those little islands out in the ocean of probability. That island's already formed. That ain't going to happen, right? Genuine happiness in an injurious, malevolent, nasty, blah, blah, blah kind of way of life. Not going to happen. So those two. So now we have to have two. If you're going to have one, the pursuit of genuine happiness, there's nothing self-righteous about that. It's actually just kind of smart. Because hedonic pleasure always just plays itself out. Sooner or later, it just runs out of gas, right? And so if we're smart, then we'll be looking for genuine happiness, cultivating it. But then for that, we simply have to be cultivating virtue, an ethical way of life, a benevolent way of life. So now we have two. But now there has to be a third factor, and that is genuine happiness. Happiness that stems from within cannot happen. No way it's going to happen if we're engaging with reality in a delusional fashion. If we don't know what's going on, we're actively getting things wrong. I mean, really core things, fundamental aspects of reality. Like, for example, being non-lucid in a dream. You're not going to find genuine happiness in a dream. You're not going to find genuine happiness, nothing sustained in a dream if you're non-lucid. Not going to happen. You're deluded. That means fundamentally you had everything wrong. Therefore, you're going to have derivatively a lot of little things wrong. And you're going to keep on looking for things that will make you happy and avoid things that will make you unhappy, in which case you're basically caught in a hedonic treadmill in a non-lucid dream. You might have pleasant experiences, that's fine, but it's still pretty much going to be hedonic. And so the cultivation of wisdom, of knowledge, of insight, knowing who we are, knowing what's going on, what's the nature of this reality. So you might recall the genuine happiness arising from ethics, the genuine happiness arising from samadhi, and then the genuine happiness arising from wisdom, from insight, of knowing reality as it is, and that's the keeper. That's the one that just, that makes the deepest mark. That brings about irreversible change. And you won't find the deepest dimension, the most durable, the most sustainable genuine happiness without the cultivation of insight, knowledge, wisdom, understanding. Okay? So those three. Take away one, the other two start to wilt on the vine. They can't really grow to their full magnitude. They can't expand to their fullness. So the cultivation of virtue, the cultivation of genuine happiness, cultivation of wisdom, of understanding. And I've read medieval Christianity. They're all three there, and they're integrated. Right. Read Buddhism, it's there. Read Hinduism, Vedanta, for example, it's there. Taoism, it's there. Aristotle, it's there. It's no question about it, it's there. He had Nicomachean Ethics, big tome on ethics. A lot to say about genuine happiness. And of course, Aristotle, what do we think about Aristotle? Boy, he knew a lot. He seemed to be interested in everything. He made a lot of mistakes, but he was brilliant, and he got so many things right. You know, that's why people still quote him, what, 2,300 years later? And so there it is, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and then Don can give a whole list of others through history, where we see they had wise things to say about virtue, wise things to say about what is happiness, and wise things to say about nature of reality. Now, what's happened in modernity, and there are all kinds of exceptions to this, but when we think of knowledge nowadays, here in the 21st century, we think, okay, who's really finding out what's going on? Who's really making discoveries, shining a bright light on the nature of reality to increase our understanding, our knowledge, insight in the nature of reality? For most people, including myself, insofar as I'm a Westerner living in the West, I mean, it's just a kind of a no-brainer. It's the scientific community. I mean, they're the ones. When we go to the media, what did you discover now? Tell us something new that we didn't know before. We don't tend to go to the theologians or the politicians. And in terms of insight, knowledge that has never been acquired before, generally not for the philosophical community either. They may make sense of, provide a context for, fresh perspectives on, new insights. But we don't generally look to the philosophical community to making these bold, great discoveries that they all agree upon. But that we do expect that of the scientific community. But now here in the 20th or 21st century, as science has devolved into its present form, a lot of scientific knowledge really doesn't have much bearing, if any at all, on genuine happiness. And moreover, to become a Nobel-winning scientist, chemistry, physics, biology, and so forth, no particular virtue is needed, except for don't fudge your data. Don't fake your data. We really frown on that. But if you don't fake your data, and if you're doing research in biology, you don't really awfully mutilate your subjects. I mean, torture them to death. You know, so especially if they're human beings, they don't like that. So that's pretty much it. But beyond that, the bar is not set very high. And the reason for that is you can be a brilliant scientist and be arrogant. You may be working for the Nazi regime or the Stalinist regime or other quite, how do you say, oppressive regimes, East and West, and still be a brilliant scientist. So what I have observed since the rise of modernity is certainly a tremendous wealth of knowledge and insight discovery. It's fantastic. I celebrate it. And there's still a lot of virtue in the world, from the Christians, from the Jews, and from humanists, of course. Of course. So there's a lot of virtue in the world as well. And especially over the last 10 years or so, then there's been shining a brighter light from psychology, positive psychology, very embryonic kind of discipline. It's very, very young. But raising the issues of genuine happiness, you know, human flourishing, going back to the Greeks, eudaimonia, brushing it off. Okay, what can we say about eudaimonia now? So they're all there. Now in the 21st century, this first, second decade, they're all there. The pieces are there. The genuine happiness is there. Eudaimonia is being brushed off and being studied by psychologists. And then the knowledge, tons of knowledge is there. And virtue, lots of emphasis on virtue, a lot of knowledge about virtue. But from my perspective, now it's in my opinion, maybe I'm totally wrong, but my opinion is there's not much integration among them. The virtue's over here, and that's where it gets sometimes cloying and obnoxious, that it's virtue, 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 look how good I am, look at all the good deeds I have. When am I going to win my prize? Where's my Nobel Peace Prize? Why aren't people recognizing me? Look at all the good I did. Look, I put my name on the building. Doesn't that tell you? I'm really, really good. You know? So the virtue, 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 but then kind of all by itself with no reference to genuine happiness, none to wisdom or insight, but then the whole massive body of knowledge, but no relationship to virtue. And then happiness, yeah, there's a little mouse squeak about genuine happiness nowadays, but the lion's roar about happiness is hedonic. It's hedonic. And hedonic pleasure, frankly, has nothing to do with virtue. Does it really? I mean, enjoying wealth, sensual pleasures, intellectual stimulation, aesthetics, and so forth. Do you ever have to be virtuous to experience hedonic pleasure, even really intense? Don't think so. And do you have to be wise and knowledgeable and have great understanding to experience hedonic pleasure? I don't think so. So in my view, I'm kind of here on my soapbox again, but I think there's a major disintegration here. From a time that was, when I look at the late medieval period, kind of ignited by Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas, there was something of a fragile integration, Because he drew from Aristotle, he drew from the whole biblical tradition, the apostolic tradition, and he wove those together, he integrated them like a craftsman into something that was really a very coherent, very extremely intelligent whole, where there was the knowledge from both the biblical and the Aristotelian, the Greek antiquity, but lots of knowledge and wisdom. There was virtue from Greek antiquity, but primarily from the Gospels and the religious tradition. And then there was references to genuine happiness, both from the Christian and from the Greek. And that was formed as a seamless whole. And so they were all there integrated in this Aristotelian scholastic vision. But it was fragile. It was fragile because it presented itself as complete. It wasn't open-ended. And of course, with the oppressiveness of the union of church and state and the stamping down of unorthodoxy, including burning people at the stake and so forth, whenever there's that kind of oppression, whether it's from a communist, like a communist Chinese regime, where there's oppression of knowledge, oppression of freedom of speech, oppression of expression, whenever coherence is maintained with oppression, they're sitting on a ticking time bomb. It's just always true. It's always true. It doesn't matter who does it. You know, whether it's a medieval church, whether it's communist China nowadays, wherever it is. Whatever it is, it's just a matter of time. It's like a tension that's driven by sheer effort, and sooner or later you're just going to be exhausted, and you won't be able to hold it together anymore. So that was something of the downfall. That coherence, that unity, that integration of genuine happiness, virtue, and wisdom in the late medieval period, if it had been open, unafraid, not demanding homogeneity of belief and ideology, open, inquisitive, willing to question one's own assumptions and beliefs and so forth, then it could have much more easily embraced the bold new discoveries of Galileo, the discoveries of the New World, of Darwin, and so forth and so on. But because it couldn't, then it was shattered. That coherence of the late medieval period, where there was really a very deep and very smart integration of genuine happiness, virtue, and wisdom, it fell apart. It was disintegrated. And I think that's what we've been living with ever since. And my sense is the entropy is kind of growing still. It's kind of like this separation. So in terms of major media, science is amoral, has nothing to do with ethics. The good life has nothing to do with ethics or wisdom. It's just money and enjoying the good life, you know. And then virtue is the lame duck, without support of wisdom or genuine happiness. It's kind of like there. It's good. It's virtue is virtue. But it's a bit stranded and vulnerable and easily slips into self-righteousness and pomposity and overbearingness without being wise and without knowing what the virtue is for. So that's probably more than you bargained for. But in short, I have had for all of my adult life, have had a great passion for doing my best to live a meaningful life. And for me, that couldn't be some kind of a vague, amorphous kind of idea, I guess this is meaningful. It had to have criteria by which from day to day, year to year, decade to decade, I can take stock of my own life and ask myself, was this a meaningful day, year, decade? Was it meaningful? Because I am completely convinced it's possible and all too easy to just kill time. Just kill time. In which case, time can pass, and it's just meaningless. It has no significance. You just ate and pooped, and that's all that really happened. And that's possible. And I wanted my life to be something more than that. That he ate this much food at the end of my life. Look at all the food he ate. And that's a lot of... Alan's contribution to entropy to the planet Earth. Voila. Oh, yeah. So, long-winded, hopefully it was meaningful. But I know it was meaningful for me. Because the integration of those, it's wonderful to have all three, but the integration that, in fact, your virtue is supporting your wisdom, and the wisdom is supporting virtue, and the virtue supports genuine happiness, and genuine happiness gives you enthusiasm for virtue, and the genuine happiness gives you enthusiasm for seeking greater wisdom. That is like three fountains all flowing into the same pool. And it's a celebration because they're all mutually, synergistically, empowering, enriching, deepening each other. And that's a real celebration. And that's universal. No one tradition has a monopoly on that. And I would love a revolution in meaning. A revolution. And the contemplative can play a key role. It really can play a key role in that. Because you cannot be an accomplished contemplative, a realized contemplative, without an ethical, virtuous way of life. Can't do it. It's not that you shouldn't do it. It can't happen. Right? And the contemplative way of life is so much, even in the Christian tradition, which we tend to associate with faith and devotion and adoration and worship and so forth. If you go back to its core, back to St. Augustine, he said, it's all about knowing God, not just believing in God, but knowing God. That's the amor Dei. The love of God is the passion to know God. It is, in fact, about knowledge. And that was clear all through the contemplative era, from the Desert Fathers right up to the 15th century. It was about knowledge. And faith is the launching pad for knowledge. Faith is not an end in itself, but it's a launching pad for knowledge. But with the rise of modern science, especially in the 17th century, to my mind, a really famous point. It was a turning point. And there was one man who was not famous and quite possibly not even very brilliant. His name was Thomas Spratt. And he lived in the latter part of the 19th century. He was an English scientist, or natural philosopher, they called him back then. And he wanted entry into the Royal Society. I'm quite sure that's what it was called, the Royal Society, which is nowadays like National Academy of Science in America. But this is the Royal Society. Well, that was the Royal Society. That was the society to belong to if you were a natural philosopher or scientist. It was where Newton and Boyle and other great, great natural philosopher scientists of the 17th century, this was their club. It was a men's club, but really prestigious, really prestigious. And they're all Christian. And this fellow, Thomas Spratt, who was junior guy, he really wanted entry into this very, very prestigious society, and still is. He wanted entry into it. And so the old guys, you know, the pioneers, the first generation or so, they saw this young whippersnapper, this young guy wanting to get in. And does everybody know this story? I'll stop if everybody knows. You know. Brian knows, because we work closely. I find it a really interesting question. You find it interesting, Brian? I do too. Okay, I'm going to continue, and I'll get to this one. I like hearing it. It's such a cool story. So there he is. He's coming up to these august, these distinguished natural philosophers, whom we still remember, we still cite to this day. And they said, gave him an entry exam. They said, look, we're going to give you a task here. And if you can come up with a satisfactory solution to the problem we set you, we'll let you in. Well, the fact that they're Christian, this is really crucial. The fact that they're brilliant scientists, that's also very crucial. And what they're working on as natural philosophers is to conceive of, to develop theories of the natural world that is law-abiding. The laws of physics. Who did that better than Newton? And the answer is probably nobody in all of history has, you know, formulated the laws of physics with such freshness and such blazing brilliance as Isaac Newton, quite possibly the greatest scientist of all time. And so they were looking for the orderliness of God's creation, and they never debated that. They were all creationists. They all believed that the universe was quite young, so they're all creationists. And they're all Christian, and they all believe that we're looking at God's creation here. And God, being infinitely wise, he's going to create an infinitely, magnificently orderly universe. And the laws of nature, which he imposes on them, that's why they call them laws, because he was the lawmaker and the law imposer. He not only imposes moral laws, thou shalt and thou shalt not, but the laws of gravity and the other laws of nature. And so they wanted to conceive of this beautiful creation of God's infinite wisdom running like a perfect clock, because that was a great metaphor, like a perfect clock. The universe modeled after Rolex. But they had a problem. I mean, they can do that without Thomas Spratt. He's a junior. What does he know? But they had a problem, and that is they're Christian. And Christian means that for the whole history of Christianity, since the time of Jesus, and then going back before then, the whole history of Judaism, there are miracles all over the place. Miracles of Moses, miracles of Abraham, miracles, of course, of Jesus, and the prophets throughout the Old Testament, the miracles of the apostles, the miracles of St. Paul. I mean, the miracles all over the place. This is divine intervention. This is a miracle where God is intervening into the fabric of nature and he's doing something anomalous that you cannot calculate using Newton's equations. Like, when will God do it? Oh, yes, about 3 seconds. Oh, there it was. Yes, right on schedule. You know, then it's not a miracle. That's just, yeah, that's called an eclipse, which we'll have this coming when the next new moon. But it's not God getting, I think it's time to have an eclipse, and zaps in there and, you know, zaps the sun. Now, that's very orderly. That's why they can predict it down to the minute, right? So here's young Thomas Spratt. You want in? Solve this one for us. We're Christians. We're not even considering becoming non-Christians. We don't want to go to hell. But we want to have an orderly universe. So what about divine intervention? God getting in there and tweaking things. Having people walk on water. That shouldn't be possible. Not according to Newton's laws. If the density of the body is greater than the density of water, you should fall into it. But Jesus walked on water. So solve that one. The opening of the Red Sea. Shouldn't happen. So solve this for us. Solve this for us. Give us, do a little mini Thomas Aquinas for us. Integrate our Christian beliefs, which we're holding fast to, with our scientific knowledge, which we're holding fast to. Make this so we can feel comfortable about this. Go for it. So he came home. He went home and put on his thinking cap. And he came back and said, I got the answer. Got the answer. In the old days, before Christianity covered the entire civilized world, before it had subdued all the savages, the heathens, and so forth, before Christianity was really then ubiquitous throughout the civilized world, then in order for Christianity fully established itself, it was necessary for God to manifest miracles through people, through divine intervention one way or another, and thereby breaking the laws of physics. It was necessary. And so that's why Jesus had to show miracles, as did Moses and so forth and so on throughout the course. And then since then also, during the opening centuries of Christian era, the early medieval period, many, many accounts of miracles, right? But now, said Thomas Pratt, now that Christianity is well established, there's no longer any need for miracles. And therefore they don't happen. So when you're running your scientific experiments and looking for new laws, you don't have to worry that, is God doing a miracle now? Do I have to do this experiment again? Maybe he did a miracle last time. You don't have to worry about it. God's not doing any more miracles. He's finished with them. And so now whatever you study, don't worry. You run the experiment well, and then you can count on it. That's the way it will be. But God wasn't teasing you like, and then, pulling a little miracle when you're trying to get a law of nature. Oh, crap, you just loused up my experiment. Don't worry about it. And then in terms of Christian views about the nature of reality, angels and devils, God himself, bear in mind this is right in the midst of that witch-hunting era. His statement here was that Christian views of the natural world, of the universe, the divine, the mundane, that it boils down to belief, simple belief. That Christian faith culminates in belief. Therefore, it's no threat to us, natural philosophers, because we're looking for knowledge. With careful empirical observation, experimentation, mathematical analysis, we're looking for knowledge. But Christianity is about belief. It culminates in belief. What does the mind of man know when it comes to divine truths? Only God is omniscient. So as Christians, we're satisfied with mere belief, because that's good enough. That's good enough for salvation. You don't need to know much. But you do need to have faith to accept, and these are Protestants, by the way, by and large, in England, that to receive the free gift of salvation, you need to be an ethical person, a virtuous person, and have simple faith, belief, and that's enough. You don't need to know much. You don't need to know. But the scientists, you need to know. And so therefore, non-overlapping magisteria. And that is, leave truth, knowledge, discovery, leave that to the scientists. So you have no competition from the Christian flock. But when it comes to religious beliefs, scientists just enter the door of the church and believe. Accept the free gift of salvation, which you're not earning, but it is a gift after all. And therefore, there's now, from now on, there will be no more conflict between religion, with no miracles, and culminating in belief, and science, which doesn't want any miracles, and is all about knowledge. So let the games begin. And now we can be all happy, with no conflict. And they said, that's good enough for us. You're in. And that spelled the death of the Christian contemplative tradition. That's a wild overstatement, but I'm going to stand by it. Because now there's no incentive within the Christian context. There's no incentive to know anything contemplatively. Because after all, salvation is a gift. You don't need to earn it. You're not going to meditate your way to heaven. And you're not going to know anything anyway, because that's what the scientists are there for. You want to know something, then join the scientific community. Learn how to know stuff. So now we have just faith and belief, often uncritical, with big emphasis on virtue. And the scientists, they're all Christians anyway, so they're getting their virtue from Christianity. So they don't need to get their virtue from science, because they already got it. They're all Christian. Right? They have Christian values, Christian virtues, and so forth. So it looked like that would work out really well. For about maybe 3 minutes. I don't know. Do we accumulate karma during lucid and non-lucid dreams? The answer is yes. Good. The answer is yes. The short answer is yes. But rule of thumb, I'll maybe go on 5 minutes late today. The rule of thumb is, and I learned this from my very first one-on-one meeting with this holiness. So useful. So useful. And that is, the greater your understanding, the clearer your mind, the more powerful your discerning intelligence is, the more weight, the more power the karma you accumulate has. So with keen insight, clear discerning wisdom, good understanding, if you engage in virtue with that, so it comes, actually this ties in with your question. If you, with such insight, understanding, maturity, and so forth, you engage in virtue, that virtue is more powerful, has a bigger impact, bigger clout, right? And likewise, if one engage in cold, deliberate, malevolent activity, we call it premeditated murder, that's the first degree, like in law, in the United States anyway, cold, premeditated, oh, gnarly. All your intelligence behind it, creating weapons of mass destruction, using all your intelligence to kill hundreds of thousands of people. That's really heavy. That's where the heaviest is. But now on that gradient, the more deluded you are, you still accumulate karma. But the more deluded you are, the less it is. So in a non-lucid dream, you're fundamentally deluded. You got it all wrong. So are you accumulating, if you kill somebody in a non-lucid dream, are you getting any karma? Yeah, not that much. You're deluded. You know what's going on, right? In Buddhist law, and it's interesting to see the parallels between Buddhist theory of ethics and modern law, if you're insane, if you're schizophrenic, or some other kind of, you know, really serious mental illness, let alone if it's based upon a neurological disorder, you're actually brain damaged, and you do something horrendously evil. Well, it is very evil, but it's not nearly as evil. The impact, the karma, is not nearly as heavy as if you did the same thing exactly, but with a clear mind. Right? So there's the whole gradient. So the clearer you are, so likewise, if you're lucid in a dream, and then you do something really malevolent, well, that's heavier. That's heavier. So this has a bearing on things like video games. And that is in a video game. Oh, look, there's nobody there. It's a video game. So you mow down all these people, or you sexually brutalize somebody in the dream and so forth. I don't know the range, but I think there's some really nasty video games out there, so I hear. And you're doing that, and of course you say, oh, but it doesn't matter, nobody's there. And you see their guts spilling all over the place. And I understand there's sexual video games as well. I've never seen them. I'm not interested. But there's going to be karma from that. There's nobody there, it's quite true, any more than there's anybody there when you're dreaming. It's still karma. And the stronger the passion, the stronger the malice, the stronger the lust, and so forth, that's going to intensify it. Right? So that's what Disholnian has told me. He told me, the greater your understanding, the greater your responsibility, because your karma is heavier. For better and worse, it's always even. So that's it. So how can we condition our minds to behave ethically and even better, do virtuous actions during lucid dreams? oh, behave ethically, and even better, do virtuous actions during the waking state. That is, make it a habit. Make it a habit, right? Just like His Holiness, when He said, I'm re-quoting Him here, but He said, you know, are you attracted to women? He said, yeah. And He said, but even in dreams, I receive some very beautiful woman, and I'm attracted to her in a dream. And you figure, okay, it's the Dalai Lama's night out. Who's going to know? You know, if he does something a little bit on the side when he's dreaming, who's going to know? So he can get away with it. I'm certain he's under intense scrutiny during the waking state. But in the dream, you know, who's the spy? And he doesn't need a spy. Because he says in the dream, he has this very strong sense, I'm a monk. So even if he's tempted in a dream towards, you know, some woman or what have you, doesn't go there, not even in the dream. Because he's a monk. He's a monk when he's dreaming, and he's a monk when he's awake. Let alone acting with out of violence or something like that. So the habits that we cultivate, doing the reality checks, the state checks, you know, and so forth in the waking state to try to ignite or catalyze a lucid dream, just generally speaking, the habits that we cultivate or that we fall into in the waking state, they will carry over into the dream. And so if you'd like to behave ethically, virtuously in the dream, then make a big habit of it continually, day by day, in the waking state, and then you'll do that as well. Bearing in mind that some people become lucid, some people are just naturally gifted. When I've led workshops with Stephen LaBerge, people who come to them from all over the world, it's usually multiple, even though it's 20, 25 people, it's always a small group, but they tend to be very international. And very often, at least, I think probably at least half of them, they're coming there because they're gifted. They're gifted. They're just natural lucid dreamers, and they want to come to the master, Stephen, not me, you know, to sharpen their skills and you know, just hone it. He's like a tennis coach. I mean, he's really good at this. And he's had you know, at least 1,000 lucid dreams himself. And so they'll come. And what I found very interesting is that while certain individuals may have a real knack, and you know, they had some coming, that they had to have a lucid dream every night, every single night. It was just so, they were so good at it. They took it seriously. They were naturally gifted, but every single night, right? But then what do you do once you become lucid? And the fact that you're lucid doesn't by any stretch of the imagination mean, oh, now you're going to do something virtuous. It means now you probably do what you like to do in the daytime, but you can't. You might get in trouble. Or you can, but you can't afford it. You know, maybe it's not nasty, but you just can't afford it. You don't have that much money for airline tickets. Whereas in a lucid dream, you can go twiddly-dee, twiddly-doo, and there you are, suddenly where you wanted to be. You know, it's a cheap ticket. And so, but that's it. People tended to just bring what they're habituated to in the waking state right into the dream state. And if they're really, you know, just totally hedonic and kind of silly and superficial in the waking state, then they'll do the same thing in a lucid dream. You know? And what I found was that simply having lucid dreams seemed to have almost negligible effect on the rest of the way of life. Just the fact that you can have a 5 or 10 minute lucid dream every night. What's the impact on the, you know, 16 hours a day that you're awake? As far as I can tell, almost nothing. By itself. Now, could that 10 minutes of a lucid dream have a big impact? Yeah. And then we keep on coming back. If that's couched in the context of you're cultivating the ability of lucid dreaming in the pursuit of genuine happiness, and it's couched in virtue, and it's in the pursuit of understanding and insight, then yeah, 10 minutes of lucid dreaming every night, that could be very transformative. But it's because of context. There we go. That was fun. At least for me. So I enjoyed it. Enjoy your meal. See you a bit later.